This is a CBC podcast. Ever wonder why our podcasts aren't exactly what we air on the radio? Or what it means to subscribe to a podcast? Or why we don't podcast Wiretap and the debaters? You'll find the answers to these questions and more on our podcasting Frequently Asked Questions page. Just head to cbc.ca/podcasting and follow the link to our FAQs.
Robots have even taken up the art of dial twisting in our radios. All we need to do is push the button and listen.
One.
This is your life.
Two.
This is your digital life.
Three.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, and come on, admit it. You know you want a robot. And what's the point of having a technology show if you can't talk about robots? So today on Spark, a look at what robots can teach us about ourselves. Plus, looking for forgiveness on Facebook. It's an emotional episode of Spark.
Rolo, answer the door.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Rolo the robot, the chromium-plated butler, is just a daydream after all.
It seems like even before we decided how we were going to pronounce the word robot, we were bossing the darn robot maid around. But what if, instead, they responded to you?
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Nora.
So first of all, can you walk me through what you did with the Roomba?
The Roomba is that little robot vacuum cleaner that looks like a big hockey puck, and it scoots around your floors vacuuming on its own. Well, recently, researchers at the University of Calgary tried a little experiment.
My name is Paul Sonnier. I am a master's student in the Interactions Lab at the University of Calgary.
Paul and his supervisor wanted to see if they could jury-rig the Roomba robot so that it would respond not to what you directed it to do, but how you behaved. So here's what they did. They took a store-bought headband thing that's designed for video games. Basically, it's supposed to read the tensing of the muscles in your forehead. And then they wrote a program so the Roomba could respond to the information that it got from the headband. So if you were tense or angry or really focused on something and your brow was all knitted, the Roomba would know that it should hightail it out of there and clean up another room. Just scurry away. So what do you think this kind of project means for the way human-robot interaction needs to be designed?
This project takes human-robot interaction from the traditional level where you are pressing buttons or you're waving wands or you're doing other things to directly control a robot. And it's taking control out of the direct consciousness of the user, and it's making it a bit less direct. So rather than you intending to control the robot in a certain way, the robot is reacting to your emotions the same way people do.
Could you engineer it so it's the opposite? If it detected that you were feeling sad, that the Roomba would come towards you and, I don't know, comfort you in some way?
Yeah, that's definitely an idea we are considering, is that if it detects that you're sad, it may respond in this way. And it may not be a Roomba. That's where we started. That's a robot that we already have and it's what we use for this project. We could possibly move on to more advanced robots that are humanoid, that they can walk on their own and that can talk to you and look at you with a webcam and react to you in different ways and also do other things for you. So instead of just vacuuming the floor and running away from you, it could bring you things, or it could talk to you, or it could just make gestures that you can understand much easily. There's some limitations with a vacuum, although a vacuum does have various uses on its own.
The utility value probably a little higher than with some others. Paul, thanks a lot for telling us about it.
Oh, no problem.
Strapping on a headband so your vacuum cleaner will take a hike is fun and all, not to mention tidy, but it points to a broader area of research into how we interact with all the computers around us. If our lives are increasingly full of Roombas and computers and smartphones and PDAs, how can we rig things so we're not constantly being interrupted and distracted?
I'm Saul Greenberg. I'm a professor at the University of Calgary working in human-computer interaction.
Saul worked with Paul Sonnier on the Roomba experiment, but his bigger project is how to design digital technologies so they blend into the background, except when we need them. So I know that Paul's project isn't your specific area of research, but what does this project say about how things like computers or AI or robots that interact with humans need to be designed? What do we need to think about?
Let's think of how we now traditionally interact with computers, particularly our desktop computer. We go to it, and on its own terms, we give it commands. It does what we want, and we usually get a task done. But increasingly, we're having more and more machines and computers come out into our world, into our everyday world. And this is part of robots, cell phones, MP3 players, even our cars are now computers, essentially. When it's part of our world, then it has to react in our world in an appropriate way. So the real question is, do we want a computer that just sits there and waits for us to direct it? On the other hand, if we had machines that actually looked at the actual real-world context, so by that I mean people's emotions, which is kind of one way to think about it, but another is what are the actions that they're doing, what's happening in the environment, what's the whole history that's gone around it, then the computer, usually through a set of simple heuristics or rules, can try to understand what the context is and make decisions based upon that.
You know, I mean, this is something that human beings do very easily with one another, judging context. I mean, if I walk into the room, you know, and your head's down, I can tell you're busy. Or if you are giving off a certain vibe, I can say, oh, that's Saul, he's angry again or whatever, right? Why is this such a difficult problem for AI if it's so easy for us as humans?
Well, almost everything we do as people is laden with the, well, for me, decades and decades of meaning that's gone into interpreting what that means. Like, remember, as kids, we spent the first 10 or 15 years of our lives understanding what all these things meant and how to react to it. Computers don't have that, and nor will they have that in the foreseeable future. So what we instead have is this really kind of set of very simple rules that most computers can do, which says that if you see this and if you see that, then it may be likely that this is actually what's going on. So they're really these kind of dumb machines that just try to do the best we can, or they can. And if there's anything we know is that these computers will get it wrong. So, Paul and I have had some discussion. In fact, Paul's supervisor, Sharon, and I have also talked about this in depth, which is, you can't assume that computers will get it right. You have to start by saying, if the computer does an action based upon an inference, then how can that action be done in a way that it can cause no harm? So in Paul's case, if we have the robot scurrying out of the way, well, you know, if in fact you were intense, it's not the end of the world. And this is a really important point, as we often design machines thinking that they're going to be correct. And really, it's the other way around.
Does it in part come down to this idea of, you know, just philosophically, is what we are doing as human beings when we figure out how to behave appropriately, is that going through a mental checklist, or is something else going on with human beings that might be harder for computers or robots to replicate?
That's a very deep question, Nora. I'm really impressed. And boy, if I could answer that, I would have a lot of research funding. If we knew how people really work, and of course, that's what psychology and social psychology and sociology is all about. If we really understood that, then we could just close down those fields and say, well, we've solved that problem.
Right.
What we do know, and there's been a series of studies of this, and is that people actually respond to computers in almost the identical social ways that they respond to each other. Study after study by these social psychologists has found that if you replace a person with a computer, measure that person's reaction to a computer doing something, and then have a person do exactly the same kind of thing, that person's response will be almost identical. So people do consider machines using our own social values that we use in dealing with other people. So it only makes sense to have machines try to copy that back.
Thanks a lot for telling us about it, Saul.
Thanks, Nora.
Saul Greenberg is a prof at the University of Calgary who studies human-computer interaction. Now, what's amazing about computers and even Roomba robot vacuums is how much emotion they can call up in us.
Hi there, I'm Sean Perpick in Regina, and I work for the CBC. I have a personal story about the Roomba that I wanted to share with you.
The vacuum cleaner is one of the common home appliances driven by a motor.
I'm here to tell you that the Roomba brought pain to my marriage.
Let us start the motor and see the fan as it revolves.
Here's the story. My beloved wife's birthday, it's easy to remember, it's on Canada Day, July 1st, and I was trying to think of a creative gift to give her. Now, it so happened about a week or two before her birthday, our longtime housekeeper retired. My spouse decided that we would clean up ourselves. And I thought, well, if I got a Roomba, two Roombas, one for upstairs and one for downstairs, we could at least delegate that task to the robot. So I buy the Roombas, I sneak them home, hide them until her birthday. And then her birthday, which is a beautiful summer day, we're sitting in the backyard and I hand the Roombas over to her. And a look of horror comes across her face. It becomes very apparent very quickly this was the wrong idea. She had three major objections. Objection one was not romantic. Well, what can I say? I'm a geek. Second, wimpy, very wimpy. Real men and women vacuum their floors. And her third objection is that it's downright creepy to have these things crawling around our house on a regular basis. It creeped her out. The Roombas, packed them up, put them on eBay, sold them very quickly for a profit. But I'm comforted by the fact that one of the Roombas, which I called Mutt, is apparently cleaning up a bed and breakfast somewhere in Nova Scotia. And the other, Jeff, is maintaining a graphic artist studio in downtown Toronto. So they're doing okay. But I'm without my robots. However, I must say, this company, US Robotics, makes another robotic product that cleans out your gutters. And, you know, I find that really interesting. Honey, how about that one?
Okay, now a gutter cleaner. That's romantic. Okay, so we've been talking a bit about how you could design robots that would respond to cues and behaviors that humans give off and even respond to our emotional states. But as Saul Greenberg mentioned, we humans are such emotional creatures that we respond emotionally to robots, even though we know they're not alive. Hi, Jaime.
Hi.
Jaime Cascio is a futurist who's thought a lot about the emotional link between humans and robots. It seems we don't just want them to respond to our emotions. As robots start to become a feature of the world around us, they'll be part of our emotional lives, too. So, Jaime, we just heard about experiments where robots, in this case a Roomba vacuum cleaner, respond to human emotions. But what's your sense of how humans respond emotionally to robots? And, you know, not industrial robots, but ones that are specifically designed to be interacting with humans.
Well, you might be surprised at how humans respond even to robots that aren't necessarily designed to be interactive. There was a terrific bit of investigative research by Joel Garreau in the Washington Post last year, where he talked to a variety of U.S. Army soldiers who work closely with these PackBot-type robots, which are really just remote control vehicles, ultimately, that they use for looking at potentially dangerous situations, sending into abandoned buildings or caves and the like, because you can shoot at a robot and it's not going to hurt anything. And it turns out that when those devices get damaged, very often the soldiers want to have that very unit repaired and not simply replaced because they've grown attached to this particular device and they start to see it like it's actually a part of the team.
Interesting.
Similarly, there was a general who was watching. It was a test for essentially resilience and ruggedness. And so the robot was being shot at and, you know, blown up and the like and still crawling along. And the general started to plead with the engineers to stop the test because he was just heartbroken seeing the device, this remote control vehicle, so damaged and torn up.
You know, I tweeted about this interview a couple hours ago, and Maya A. wrote, "I love my Roomba and affectionately mimic my Wii's voice. How emotionally attached will we be to robots?" And I guess that raises the question is, as we start to see more of these in our real environments, do you think that our emotional responses are going to change or develop in some way?
Well, I think our emotional responses will mimic the kind of emotional response we have to pets. That is, a clear presence of empathy, a sense of responsibility towards the system, and, you know, some level of affection towards it, even if it can't respond in kind necessarily, because that's the way we've evolved. I mean, our brains are evolved to have that kind of, you know, empathetic response to seemingly helpless little creatures. And I think that's a good thing, actually. Now, we can say, oh, it's a robot, it's just a toy, it's just a machine, a tool. And yet they are, in their motion, in the noises they make, in some cases, you know, they may even be explicitly designed to do this, they elicit that kind of emotional response. You know, there's a robot toy that's available now, the Pleo. It's a little robot dinosaur.
Right.
But apparently, if you pick it up by its tail, it will start to kick its legs and make a wailing noise as if you're hurting it. And you put it down, and it actually will run away from you and hide.
Oh.
Very much like what an animal would do.
Can we be purely speculative for a moment? Can you tell us about some possible applications that you see for, either sort of domestic robots or these sort of AI applications in future years?
Other kinds of domestic robots? Well, there's also the whole babysitting concept. In this case, you can imagine it having, this kind of device having some way of monitoring the child. A camera, maybe some kind of health sensors, detect body temperature and the like, so that it can give an early warning that, the kid may be becoming sick or the kid is upset in some way.
You mean that it would sort of communicate information about the status of the baby to the parents?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so what I would see moving ahead with robots isn't so much the fearful future of robots taking our jobs, robots taking over our lives. This isn't the Matrix. It's more of a future of robots serving as smart tools, augmentations to our day-to-day lives to help us do things more effectively, more safely, more easily. And in the course of doing so, developing that kind of pet-like emotional give and take so that we develop a sense of bonding or a sense of affection even for, these increasingly important tools in our lives.
Jamais, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Every day in our homes and offices, hundreds of these little robots are doing more things for us than we realize, taking care of the routine tasks and leaving us free to live and work and play in greater ease and comfort and safety.
You're listening to Spark on CBC Radio 1.
Well, the first cliche is undoubtedly, it's been such a pleasure working with you guys. Then there's, I'm leaving to, quote, pursue other opportunities.
I'm Nora Young, and yes, you're listening to Spark on CBC Radio 1. It's a sad reality that people are getting laid off and outsourced, taking a package or just moving on. Here at the CBC too, of course. And there's that one common feature of lots of workplaces now, and that's the all-staff goodbye email from a colleague who's leaving. The messages invariably say that the writer is taking on new challenges, and they invite everyone to keep in touch, even if you've never been in touch with them in the first place.
Hi, my name is Megan Houston, and I'm a freelance writer in New York. And I wrote this article for Slate.com recently about the ubiquitousness of goodbye emails. I was surprised how people felt compelled to do this. It sort of felt like it had become part of the ritual of losing one's job. But I've also long been fascinated by how people get these workplace habits. How do people behave in these organizations? And what principles do people absorb it sort of in the water cooler, in the water cooler water, and how that's changed throughout time?
And as Megan looked further into this phenomenon, she found that authors of these emails were trotting out common, predictable touchstones.
I found that they're surprisingly bland. There's this extreme, I would call it an extreme politeness.
As Husted went through sheaves and sheaves of goodbye emails that she collected from friends and colleagues, she found an eerie and yet also almost boring familiarity.
They're omitting any resentment they might have. I mean, I saw people who I know just because I knew them personally, because that's where I first went to find, the source material for this article. I knew these people had very legitimate grievances against their employers and against some of their colleagues, but of course they made no mention of that ever. I think people have a couple of different fears. I mean, it's partly technology. People are worried that it'll get forwarded and then perhaps posted online, and that's happened on a couple of occasions. When people have written angry goodbye letters to their employer, they tend to end up on blogs and then the floodgates of comments and ridicule opens.
Case in point, Husted offers the example of a super annoyed AIG vice president who, well, not to put too fine a point on it, was whining recently about the U.S. government's effort to claw back his bonus. He complained about it in an ultra-angry resignation by all-staff email.
His extensive "I quit and goodbye" message was forwarded to both the New York Times and the Huffington Post, turning him, for a few days at least, into the number one bad boy of American finance. And these days, that takes some doing, don't you think? Well, after we talked to Megan Husted, we wanted to get your two cents, so we blogged about this and we linked to her article and asked for comments. And of course, we knew you wouldn't quit us. The Uber Geek writes, "I don't think there's ever a good way to announce a resignation or firing via email. Leaving a job can be one of the most traumatic events in somebody's life, so I don't think email really does it. There are just too many ways to misinterpret things. At our office, communication of departures is always done on a one-on-one or meeting environment where people can talk about it." And then there was this one. Ethan Henry said, "I once sent the entire text of T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men as my goodbye email with nothing else." Ethan, I'm sure that many people could relate to the last lines of that poem. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. You know, related to this whole email farewell thing is email regret. You know, when you fire off an email and you, oof, immediately wish you could take it back. Well, users of Google's Gmail service rejoice. They now have a new email retraction feature. So the next time you lose it and send off that email you know you're going to regret, you can just quietly pull it back by clicking undo. But hurry, you've only got 5 seconds to do it. And then you're toast. Seriously, sometimes, of course, you can't take back what you've said or done. All you can do is apologize from the heart and hope for the best. Al Ray has recently taken to what he calls the Facebook mea culpa.
"This is a story about Facebook and addiction. Not to Facebook, to alcohol. This is a story about using modern technology to heal primitive emotions. This is a story about forgiveness and mea culpas. This is a story about me. Info: Al Ray. Age: 45. Status: married. On Facebook, I'm a newbie. You might have gathered that by the use of the word newbie, which you last likely heard on IRC chat back in 96. I joined FB, that's what we call it, you know, 3 weeks ago. I have 359 friends. I haven't had that many friends since I was buying rounds at a booze can on Queen Street West in Toronto 25 years ago. I live in Winnipeg now, cleaned up my act, left a lot of the old crew behind. Over the years, before computers, I'd bump into a few of them, or they'd look me up. How you doing? Glad to hear. Uncomfortable silence. Take care. Facebook makes life easier. In cyberspace, no one can hear your silent scream. Non-committal reacquaintance. Cheaper than a phone call. Less cloying than a Christmas letter. But sometimes the road back to the past is so thorny and tangled, you need a machete to find your way through. That's when your Facebook message starts with, I don't know how to begin. Or, I am so, so sorry. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they call these mea culpas Step 9. None of the counselors I talked to at treatment centers or any of my friends in the program had heard of Facebook Step 9s. No one really frowned upon it, but they don't do much frowning upon in AA. So I turned to the AA Big Book. It was written 80 years ago, but there's often advice that can be applied to modern technology. As usual, the writing is charming and plain. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. If it's good enough for AA, it's good enough for me. And so I started writing Facebook letters. Private messages, of course. I wasn't hanging my dirty laundry on the wall, so to speak. The first was easier than I thought. Turns out things hadn't been that bad, really. Just a run-of-the-mill drunken fortnight, homeless in London, under Mrs. Thatcher. Somewhere in there, we met Dustin Hoffman. My second reconnect was much, much harder. Her last communication to me was a letter, one of the paper ones, with a stamp. It was mailed to me 15 years ago, a year after we last saw each other. She was over the pain enough, she said, that she could finally write my name. Ever been winded reading? try reading that about yourself. The hell of addiction isn't the craving, it's the shame. Now Facebook had found her, miles away, in a whole new life. I rehearsed my message. I backspaced. My fingers hummed over the enter key like a hovercraft. I hit send. And then the wait. With Facebook, there's no way to tell if they even got your note. Maybe she doesn't check Facebook anymore. Or maybe you're unforgivable. A wise drunk once told me to think you're the worst person in the world is just another form of narcissism. It's like you can't just be a horse's ass, you have to be Seabiscuit's ass. And then one day, faster than mail, comes her reply. First off, delight. Delight that I'm alive. I was so sick from booze, I'm getting props for still breathing. And then the rest, how well she's doing, her job, her husband, how glad she is that I'm doing well. Then an invitation. Keep in touch. And so we have. It's hard to describe the joy. Scrooge's jig when he found out the spirits had done it all in one night. Status update. Al is content.
Al Ray is a comedy writer and director of the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, and he lives in the Peg. That's it for this edition of Spark. A Spark is made by Elizabeth Bowie, special guest producer, rock stars Sean Perfect and Pedro Mendez, and me, Nora Young, and by
Paul Sonia,
Saul Greenberg,
Jemay Cascio,
Megan Husted,
Al Ray,
and
Rolo the Robot.
And we use blog comments and Twitter comments from Maya A., Ethan Henry, and the Uber Geek. Spark is made with Creative Commons music and effects. Find the artists and song titles up at the blog. That's also where you can find special advance audio. Like next week, we'll be broadcasting a great interview with James Boyle. He has a really cool argument about changing copyright to help out our common culture. But the interview is already up at the Spark blog, and I would love to get your feedback on it. That way we can include comments on next week's show. Please check it out at cbc.ca/spark or drop me an email, spark@cbc.ca. I'm Nora Young, secretly a robot. Talk to you next time.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.